Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Hey there, it's Rachel Ballinger, and I am thrilled to invite you to Rachel Uncensored, my podcast where I get real with my friends and celebrity guests, where we talk about all sorts of topics. From personal stories to hot button issues, we cover it all. New episodes drop every Wednesday, so make sure you tune in on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss out on the fun and candid conversations we have here on Rachel Uncensored.
Hello and welcome to the IGN UK podcast. I am Alex, and this week I'm Chris. Even
should I start again? I've never seen that before.
Hello and welcome to the IGN UK podcast. I am Chris. This week I'm joined by Alex.
Hello.
And we have yet another special guest, a very special one this week. It's Mr. Neil Blomkamp, the director of District 9, Elysium, and the forthcoming Chappie, which is actually in cinemas today, the day this drops. Cool. So exciting times. How are you doing, Neil?
Good, man. Yeah. I feel good. Yeah.
How long are you in town for?
I'm in town for like 24 hours.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I leave tomorrow for Paris, and I got in very recently. I don't know, yesterday sometime.
Yeah. Oh, well, thanks for giving us a full hour. That's very generous.
No, totally.
So we're going to get onto Chappie, but we thought we'd kick off by talking a little bit about movie robots. And I'm wondering, what is your favorite movie robot, if you have one?
I'd have to say my favorite movie robot is probably Ed 209 from RoboCop. I think that the visual lines on it, and also how it ties into the screenplay and what they were going for, is amazing. So yeah, Phil Tippett, and I think it was designed by Craig Hayes, the kind of industrial Detroit automaker look of that robot is tough to beat. So that would be my number one robot.
And is he an inspiration on maybe one of the robots in your new film, Chappie?
He is, yeah.
It's the Moose, isn't it?
It is the Moose. I mean, you know, what one thing I'm kind of noticing about myself as I get older is that I'm, like, the influences in Chappie tend to be, hopefully, you know, the audience will tell me if I'm wrong, less influenced by other people's fiction in terms of story and setup. And the influences are, like, more aesthetic. So my favorite robot in history, RoboCop, I want to tip my hat to that robot. And it's like, I have my own evil robot. So, you know, that's me kind of being, it's me kind of like bowing down to the Phil Tippett robot. That's essentially what it is. And also that because, you know, I have a background in 3D effects, I kind of kitbashed that robot together using a similar process to what, not exactly what they would have done with that robot, but the whole kitbashing model building phase of like the ILM sort of 70s, 80s way of doing things where you cannibalize other models to make something is how I made the Moose. So yeah. I just bought up like a whole bunch of things like Bradley fighting vehicles and dirt bikes and assembled the Moose out of real life engineering elements. And made it bipedal and, you know, so yeah.
So wow. It started off as a model kit before it was a CG animated
thing. It started off as a 3D CG model kit.
Right, gotcha.
So the thing that happens with CG is because you, like in the real world, this is the problem I have with a lot of film design, right, is that a lot of designers working today have never needed to understand, like they don't come from tool and die machinery. Yep. They don't know how lathes work. They don't know what center of gravity means to design. They don't understand how like suspension works on a dirt bike. Like, they just don't get it, right?
Yeah.
And they can draw whatever they want, and whatever they want can be realized in a photorealistic way without ever needing to go through a manufacturing process. So, and I don't like that look. And that is what a lot of like 21st century design looks like because it doesn't need to be realized out of like, plastic and aluminium. So, one thing that gives realism to design is if it actually comes from a place of realism. So now the moose is completely unrealistic. Let's assume it's ridiculous because it is.
Yeah.
But you can still design it to look like it kind of is actually functional.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, it doesn't seem so far out there that it's from another planet. It's
exactly. Yeah.
It's kind of, you can imagine the military constructing that in a few years' time.
Yeah. So in order to do that, I kind of wanted to pilfer as many real pieces as I could,
right,
which were designed with all of the real engineering processes in mind, and assemble them into this kind of bastardized, you know, bipedal shape.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I did. And then I sent that model to Weta, and then Weta, basically they rendered him, and then they two-dimensionally painted on top of him to create more detail and like what their artists would naturally do to the design.
Right.
And then when I liked all of that, we kind of sealed it and then remodeled it from scratch at Image Engine, like modeled every bolt perfectly. Yeah.
So how long does that kind of process take? Because it seems like
It takes long, yeah. I mean, you know, the process in Chappie was different to some degree from how you would normally go about doing it. And the moose didn't need to fall into this process. It was more for the robot of Chappie.
Yeah.
But the moose did go back and forward in the same way, although it didn't need to. But so for Chappie, if you imagine that the lead robot is basically the lead character, it means that you're going to have to carry that robot through 1,000 shots in the movie, yeah, and he's going to have to convey all of the emotion required of a lead actor.
Yeah.
With shots like this, you know, and you know, the dexterity of like millimeter precision of hands and joints. So if you take simple stuff, like if you hold your palm up in front of you and you rotate it, the way that that's happening is the bones in your wrist are crossing over one another,
yeah,
right? The biomechanics of that. So when you build a robot to mimic what your actor is doing, like what Sholto did, how is he going to do that?
Yeah.
So what we wanted to do was hit every single design wall that we could hit to be like, okay, the mobility stops at this point.
Yeah.
His ear is crashing into the geometry on his shoulder. We have to redesign that. And we did that backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards, but we always kept it in 3D. And only when we knew the robot could do every motion that that the human could do was the point that we went into 3D manufacturing, like 3D printing and milling,
yep,
to actually hold a robot. You know?
Wow.
Yeah. So it was back to front. I dislocated my shoulder playing rugby when I was a kid.
Right.
And like holding my palm out, I just kind of like messed my shoulder up. It always happens.
Oh, no.
I always
our first
do.
Injury on the podcast. Yeah.
No, it's a full like rotator cuff injury, but whatever. It's life in the big city.
Well, I guess we're talking about the movie now. So where did the idea for this come from? Because I believe you first designed Chappie in 2003. Is that right?
Sort of. Not exactly. Mm. Like Alive in Joburg very definitively led to District 9. Which was a short that I made in about 2005. This movie was not the direct descendant of the short that I made in 2003. So when I was writing Elysium, I was dealing with a lot of robots in that film. And at the same time, I was listening to the South African band, Die Antwoord, the rappers. They were just playing in my house when I was writing Elysium. And so out of nowhere, I had this idea where I was like, what if that band raised one of these robots and it was like a sentient robot? Like, what would that be? So that was the idea. That's a weird concept, but
yeah.
That is literally how the idea was born. And then if I looked back to 2003, I was like, well, I already put a robot in South Africa. I might as well let some of the design influences of that robot carry over to the movie, because why not? And so the two main things that I took were like the bunny ears from the robot, mm-hmm, and the name of the company, which was Tetraval, and just kind of, you know, put them in 2013 when I started Chappie.
Cool. And so what are the influences on the movie then, the story? Because I was making my little notes when I was watching, and RoboCop I wrote down, Frankenstein, and mm-hmm, what influenced this story when you were putting it together?
Well, hopefully nothing. I mean, I think that pop culture just like goes into your head at some degree and kind of floats around, and you may be aware or not aware of influences. But on paper, the only story influence, the only influence I can think of, which is non-story, is Ed 209 influencing the moose.
Mm.
The actual fiction, like the actual story, hopefully shouldn't be influenced by anything else. It should be a really weird story of a droid raised by, you know, by this weird band.
Yeah.
The parallels, like I haven't seen Pinocchio in years, but people have brought up Pinocchio.
Mm.
And Frankenstein is an interesting one as well, but essentially the idea of giving life to something inanimate, you know, is probably, you're probably going to be able to draw conclusions or draw analogies to those works.
Yeah, sure. We had an email, one of the tweets. Let me get one of the tweets out. Elizabeth Marshall asked, what was the most challenging part about filming, putting the film together? Mm-hmm. What was the biggest kind of challenge?
I hate filming in general. Like, right. I loathe filming.
Yeah.
So the whole process from the day the camera started rolling to the end was disgusting. So I'm going to lump the whole shooting process in as really difficult. But it's weird because when I was making it, I actually sent an email to the financier of the film and I was like, I don't know why I'm finding this so hard. And I couldn't, that's what was irritating me, was like, I couldn't put my finger on what it was. But I had a really tough time in Johannesburg shooting the movie, and it was just hard going, you know, which at the same time makes me feel happy, because like the worse it is making it, the better sometimes it is. And I knew I loved the movie. I just knew it was also like tough to make.
Yeah. Do you prefer the writing, the screenwriting process or the editing process?
No, writing's even worse.
Right. Okay.
So the order,
change.
Yeah. Yeah. The order it goes in is writing is the absolute worst.
Yeah.
Followed by shooting. Right.
Yeah.
The best part is the part, well, all of the other parts are really good, but prior to writing is probably the best part, because prior to writing is like pure creative freedom,
yeah,
where, you know, you're working on a treatment or a scriptment or whatever you want to work on to formulate the idea. And you're probably also doing artwork. So like you're designing the world and you're thinking of just the tone and the atmosphere of everything. Screenwriting tends to be a very sort of mechanical, mathematical, like nuts and bolts kind of thing, and I find it very unartistic, so I don't dig it. Mm. And then shooting's really tough, but then when you go back into post, like editing is awesome, you know, working with the musician for, I mean, Hans Zimmer on this I absolutely loved. Visual effects is cool. I like everything, really. It's just those two processes.
Fair enough. We had one quite funny tweet, I thought. James Bush wants to know, why is Sharlto Copley not in it?
Right.
Obviously he is, but
fair enough.
But yeah, you don't see him, so maybe, you know, some people haven't picked up on that. But I'm intrigued to know what he did beyond just lending his voice to the role, because I think there was mocap going on and how that worked.
Well, it's a lot more than lending his voice to it, because you know, for me on set it's basically like he's an actor. Like there really is no difference. If I had designed the robot to be non-anthropomorphic and it was like a couple of stories high and 700,000 tons, I could not have used an actor, right? It would be like, we have to move all of these cars and this is where the robot's going to go. But in the case of an anthropomorphic robot that has human-like qualities, why would you not use an actor?
Yeah.
So that means like Shaul, on the day you're shooting it, you're not re-recording his voice later like a Pixar film. He's just acting the role out, and everything about it, the way I think of it is like $20 million of makeup.
Right.
That's kind of how I think of it.
Yeah, you know?
It's just extreme wardrobe, basically, where they paint him out.
Yeah. And was he wearing anything to make him more robot-like for him, or more gangster-like for his kind of efforts?
Well, yes and no. Basically, what you want to do is you want to cover the actor in like a gray lycra kind of outfit, something that will reflect light in the most neutral way possible, so that the visual effects artists know how light is hitting him and how shadows are affecting him. And also, obviously, if he's wearing like luminous red, he's going to be bouncing lights all over the set that you don't want, right?
Yeah.
So you want him neutral. So on District 9, it was the same as District 9. On District 9, we had like gray lycra outfits for the guy that played all the aliens, Jason Cope. And then his like genitals were like shrink-wrapped in like the gray lycra. So then Shaul wanted to wear shorts, and he kept talking about how it was for his character.
Right.
It wasn't clear, though. It was actually for his character.
Or his nuts.
I don't know. Yeah.
Fair enough. Simon Collins wants to know why you gave Hugh Jackman a mullet.
Well, I'm just a fan of like over-the-top characters. And yeah. I like the idea of blurring reality a little bit, because De Unfuert was in the movie and they play themselves. So I wanted him to be Australian. I knew that much.
Yeah.
And I wanted him to use his like natural accent and not be manipulating anything. But then as soon as I came up with that, I basically just went back over the line into fakeness again and just pushed the character to some ridiculous place where I sent him an email of some Australian kid in the outback with this awesome mullet. And he was like, that looks...
That's every kid in the outback, isn't it? That's
Yeah.
He was up for it, was he?
Oh, yeah, he was totally up for it. Yeah, yeah. I sent him some other photos of like Australian farmers with that kind of khaki, and they have like blue pockets.
Yeah.
And he was like, I'm down. It was awesome.
And what was it like working with Sigourney Weaver?
It was really good. I mean, both of them, like, remember how I said I hate shooting?
Yeah.
So a big part of like hating shooting less is when you have really, really talented people. The fame and the, you know, the sort of cachet that they bring with them on set at the point that you're shooting is completely irrelevant. It doesn't matter, right? At that point, you want like the best person to bring that character to life.
Sure.
And you also want the person that like creates the least headaches for you.
Yeah.
And so when you have actors that are as well known and as kind of, you know, they're in that rarefied territory, it's incredible to have them be such normal, nice people, you know, and they just make your life easy. They come up with ways for things to work smoother, not more difficultly.
Right.
And so that makes me just automatically be a massive fan of both of them. Yeah. I try to do that though. Like I try to not put myself in a position where I'm going to have like just a real uphill battle, you know, yeah. Like Matt was the same way on Elysium, like just very easy to work with. Yeah. And it's, you're kind of like stunned by the level of like when you give notes as a director and they're acting as, classically trained actors, you know, where you're like, can you do this with the line or that with the line? Like they really are just that good, you know, they'll do exactly what you're asking for.
Right.
So you better ask them correctly. Cause it's like, it's going to be on you. So yeah, I loved both of them.
Was there much kind of to and fro? Like, did they give you feedback saying, well, I think the character should be more like this?
I'm trying to remember. I mean, if that were to happen, that would happen in the screenwriting phase. Right. That would be like when you handed them the script. No, I don't really remember that happening. I mean, one thing that I did especially compared to District 9, was I wanted to keep the movie much more sort of improv free. I wanted it to be, you know, much more locked down and sort of script specific.
Yeah.
And I did do that. But interestingly, with Hugh, I didn't realize how good he was at improv.
Right.
He was like crazy good. He was working with an actor at one point that like wasn't remembering his lines correctly. And it was kind of annoying. So then I went to Hugh and I was like, listen, it's not going to work with him. He doesn't remember the line. So you go full improv, since he's basically not remembering how to do it, and just completely mess with him. And that's how I discovered how good he is, right? Like he completely just like dressed the dude down. It was amazing. And so then I kind of wanted to do that more, you know, and this was right after asking Shaul to like stop with the improv.
Yeah.
So then improv kind of crept in a little bit, gotcha. You know, but yeah, he's just one of those guys that's an all-rounded, like very talented performer, you know. Yeah. It's cool.
Yeah. I'm also intrigued. You must have done a lot of research and met with a lot of sort of technical people about this. How close is some of this to happening in real life, to having, you know, robot armies on the streets as our police, drones in effect? And
Well, I think, you know, the big distinction to make is that what they term as strong AI, actual artificial intelligence, if you put that over to, you know, the side of the conversation for a second and you're left with soft AI or weak AI, in the realm of weak AI, which is basically not artificial intelligence at all, but it's really just a set of programmable responses to situations, that realm of reality, I think, is very close to us. Like if you take companies like Boston Dynamics and like, you know, their anthropomorphic pet man robot, or you look at some of the dog, the four-legged robots that they have, I don't think we're far away. I think we're within a decade of like actually technically being able to deploy a few hundred robots that kick in doors and physically behave like, you know, move like humans. The discussion about actual artificial intelligence, though, is so complicated and is so deep that you can't talk about it without getting into like almost philosophy and religion. They just all cross over into one thing. You know, you start getting into the nature of the soul and what consciousness is. And as I get older, my points of view on that seem to change. Like, I mean, no one really knows what they're talking about if they start talking about AI. Like, even researchers in AI, I don't think know exactly. Like, they can't. The term qualia is a word used to define experience, like basically being conscious, like looking at a sunset, right? So scientists talk about how they can describe the inputs from like the nerve, you know, the nerve bundles in your eyes and how they run into whichever part of your brain needs to decode that data. They can explain that. But the actual recognition and feeling of looking at a sunset is inexplicable. So qualia as a discussion and intelligence that can think up things that we're not thinking up, like another intelligence, you get into such crazy territory there that that as I get older, I'm not sure is going to happen in the way that we think it's going to happen.
Yeah.
Like when I was younger, I used to think like, ah, it's just like a given. It's a bunch of neural, you know, inputs, and the brain is nothing more than an organic microprocessor, and you're running electrical current through it, and you know, with X number of synapses, you're going to get like this response. And it's like, no, I don't think that anymore. I think there's some undefinable quality that is the life force that we don't understand or know. Yeah, that's my point of view now. Yeah. And that's weird. It changed during the making of Chappie.
That's interesting.
Well, because I've got a 4-year-old daughter, so I've seen her come from, nothing, essentially, up to now. And the way that she learns is just incredible. And how you would kind of... Well, it surprises me every single day.
Yeah.
And obviously, you're mimicking that with Chappie to some extent. But how that would actually become a reality, I've no idea.
Yeah, it's kind of... It's like the idea that life provides order in the universe, you know? And if you have a tree or you have a flower or something growing, it's quite hard to actually describe what force is at play that is a mechanism that is working, that when it dies, that order is lost and that entropy returns. That's a very hard thing to summarize.
Yeah.
But whatever that life force is, because I think dogs are sentient. I think sentience is just a gradient, you know, down to where it's an insect, it's very difficult to determine.
Yeah.
And it just gradients up depending on how much mental capacity they have.
Yeah.
So I don't know what is injected into any organism that exhibits life.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff.
This is the deepest conversation we've ever had on this podcast.
Thank you, Neil.
Right.
Raise the quality. I'm going to throw in a tweet from someone. Gazamate says, on a scale of nervous to excited, what are your feelings towards directing the next entry in the Alien series?
Excited. Yeah, I'm not, I don't, you know, for whatever phase I'm in my career now, I think I think two things are at play. One, I'm like relatively young, and two, I'm on a personality level, I'm not susceptible as much to the whole like fear of following up to something, or even if it's your own work, you know, like Elysium not living up to the what District 9 was, that it doesn't affect me in the same way that I think it affects a lot of other artists. Like, I'm willing to take big swings all the time until people won't give me money. It doesn't affect me like that. So my thing with Alien is like, I don't sit up at night being like, oh my God, I wonder if I'm going to be able to, you know, follow in these great films' footsteps. It's more like, I'm a fan of Alien. I'm a fan of Aliens. And Alien 3 onwards went in a direction I didn't want. So like, I just get the chance to try to tell my version of how I think it should have happened. It's just like pure excitement, you know.
But it's interesting. Last time I spoke to you was around the time of Elysium, and I asked you about Star Wars, and you said you didn't have any interest in making a Star Wars movie because you had too many original stories you wanted to tell.
Still true, yeah.
So is this come... I mean, obviously, Alien is a long-standing franchise. Is this because you had a great idea that you came up with that you pursued them, or...?
Yeah. I mean, I've definitely... I pursued them to the point that Fox didn't even know I was working on it. So... you know, that in itself is just unique. Like, you should always be working on something that the studio doesn't even know you're doing. And that way you're like, I want to do that by the time it's done. And then they can decide, you know?
Yeah.
I think when you get hired to do something, you're in dangerous territory. But, so the truth about, you know, projects that are my own, like the thing that's annoying about films is they take 3 years to make. It's a constant thing that I face all the time, which is like, whatever you commit to, you're going to be out of the game with everything else. Mm. And you're going to be doing this one thing for that amount of time. So, that's a very true thing. I mean, you know, that would still be my answer with almost everything. It's just that Alien isn't almost everything. Alien is like the one thing that's just, I actually think it's the first science fiction film I ever saw.
Right.
And it's my first memory of like film. And so it's just emblazoned into my head in a way that it would be a shame for me to not do it for myself. You know, I'll even if it doesn't live up to what people want, like for my own self, like I need to at least try.
So was it that it was your first memory as a film? Is that what drew you to the project and made you so passionate about it?
Just to the world, you mean, of the first and second one?
Yeah.
I think the combination of what Ridley did and the usage of Giger's Freudian sexual terror imagery, and the setup of the first film, and then what Cameron did with the second film, like what just the perfect storm of what those ingredients were, and for my own like visual style and what I like, and it just was this weird, perfect unity of everything, you know. And I think that's really what it is. It's just, yeah. I can't think of anything that comes close to it in terms of an existing franchise.
Yeah.
I mean, my other favorite character, like I don't want to participate in this world, is Batman.
Yeah.
And I think like the Chris Nolan Batman films are incredible. Yeah. You know, like for me, for my own aesthetic and taste, I think they're amazing.
Yeah.
And that's a separate thing. It's kind of character driven, but Alien is a unique thing for me. It's a unique storm of perfect ingredients.
Was this the first film that got greenlit via Instagram?
I don't know. That's an interesting question. Maybe. That's a very interesting question.
But you put that concept art out there.
Well, I think, you know, the thing that I find that it kind of ties in a little bit with what you were saying about living up to people's expectations and are you nervous? And like, this is a little bit of the same discussion where I think that people think I was like playing some kind of game with the studio where I was like releasing stuff to try to create hype, to try to go back to them. And like, I'm totally not Machiavellian in that way at all. Like, I'm just not. And the debate was an internal debate, actually. It was a debate where, I don't think I'm a movie director. I think I'm an artist. And I think movies are probably like, for me, they're the pinnacle art form. But the pinnacle art form requires like tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars of other people's money that needs to return an investment for them on the cash. And that means that there are certain things that come with that that limit you as an artist, right? So you can have full control on a film. Like Chappie is about as close to having, virtual carte blanche in a film as you can have, less the fact that it's 2 hours and it has three acts and there's a list, right? Mm. So it's like if you want to just create something that's a piece of art that just really like winds people up, you know, something hyper offensive or crazy or whatever it might be, this is the wrong thing for you. So I have that internal debate sometimes where I'm like, I'm just wondering if this is the right avenue for me. And that's what Alien was, where I was like, maybe I should just go off for a couple of years and do some other stuff. And I had this all of this accumulated work of a project I thought was really awesome. So I was like, I know there's going to be some fans out there that like this. Here you go. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what happened. And so it's not, nothing is premeditated. Mm-hmm. I still hadn't picked a project. 2014 was really weird for me. I loved Chappie and I loved working in post on Chappie, you know, working with Zimmer, cutting it together, working on VFX. It was very relaxing. It was kind of awesome. But I didn't know what I was going to do next. And I came up with so many ideas. I came up with like many films. And I just couldn't like choose one. And my apprehension with Alien was that I had never worked with someone else's material, you know? Yeah. And especially not even someone else. At this point, it was like, I'm going to count Fincher in with the third one, even though the third one I don't like as much as the first two. It's still three awesome filmmakers. It's not about living up to it and being nervous about it. It's like, I just don't want other people to tell me what to do, which is a different thing. Yeah. Well, we think in this film, this should happen because it happened in that one. That kind of scared me a little bit. So then I was like, I'm just not going to do it. I'll put it out.
Yeah.
But then, I spoke to Sigourney and like, I love Sigourney and her wanting to execute the story that I wrote. And she thinks it's the right story for Ripley, that I was like, nah, I'm fully going to do this.
Mm.
And also like my place looks like this with all the stuff everywhere. Yeah. So Terry actually was drinking a glass in the morning when I was like leaving to go edit Chappie recently. And it's the life cycle of the xenomorph, like on the glass.
Right.
And she was looking at it and I was like, I don't know what to do. And she was like, is there something wrong with your brain? She's like, I'm drinking out of a glass that has a frickin' facehugger on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you don't know what you want to do next. Yeah. You know what I mean? And it's like, our house is covered in xenomorphs.
Yeah.
So I was like, you have a point.
Yeah. It was like a good opportunity.
Yeah.
So where does this fit in? Is this film going to shoot when Prometheus sequel shoots? And are these going to be running side by side?
I don't think they'll be running exactly side by side, but I don't want to get into it too much, though.
Yeah.
Like I will try to keep some cards close to my chest. Yeah. But it's Ridley is producing it, which is amazing too, because he's like one of my favorite filmmakers. So, yeah, I'm stoked.
Yeah, it's cool that Ridley Scott's involved as well.
So cool.
We were going to ask about the game Alien Isolation as well. If you've played that,
I have played that.
Yeah, what are your thoughts on that game?
I think it's amazing. I mean, even from the first screen grabs, just the quality of the art direction and how it looks. Like I'm such a visual person that. The narrative of stuff is like neither here nor there for me. Like sometimes it's literally about imagery.
Yeah.
And when I saw the images, I was like, shit, it can't be that good. And then I played it and it was like, to me, it was that good.
It's like, so well done compared to the original movie with the soundtrack and everything.
Yeah, it's ridiculous, you know? Yeah, I mean, it's actually interesting because it raises an interesting design question for me, which is that when Alien was made, it was cutting edge.
Yeah.
Mother was cutting edge. And a green CRT monochromatic monitor was cutting edge. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like Aliens, the director's cut with Reel 2 reinserted when you're on the colony planet and it's like he's getting printouts with like dot matrix paper with like holes down the side. That shit was real, man. Yeah. On the planet in that future, that was cutting edge.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting debate if you look at it from my standpoint, which is like, do I make my cutting edge? Is it cutting edge? Or is it actually closer to the first two?
Yeah.
Because I want it to be like, it has the same parent. It's a genetic offspring of the first two movies.
Yeah.
And Alien Isolation actually made me kind of question that a lot because they got it so perfect with all of the late 70s, early 80s, like tech.
Yeah.
You know, it's really cool.
Well, that's it, because you're not actually exploring the Nostromo, but it feels like you are. Mm. At least it exists in the same universe.
Same world. Yeah, it's all about the same world.
Yeah.
I know you're a fan of first-person shooters. What are your favorite games of all time?
Of all time?
Yeah.
Oh, dude, all time is just an easy answer. Half-Life 2 Deathmatch. Half-Life 2 Deathmatch, I'll kill anyone in this building. I'll kill anyone in London at Half-Life 2 Deathmatch.
Like, that's a challenge. That's a challenge, for the listeners.
No, seriously, like, it's not even a joke. You know, Half-Life and probably those for FPS, you know, would be my favorites. The one I'm playing a lot of at the moment is Battlefield. I really love Battlefield a lot. And I just moved my... I had a few game computers at home and like we're selling that house. So I haven't played it in a month probably, which is the longest I haven't played that game in a few years. And I flirted with Titanfall a lot. I like Titanfall too. Trying to think what else I've really been into lately.
So is it primarily kind of multiplayer FPSs that you're playing?
Yeah.
What do you think about like some of the storylines that you get in kind of FPSs? It feels like...
I don't know what to make of them. I mean, it's... I think that I'm definitely more film literate than I am game literate.
Right.
But I'm actually in some senses more interested in games. Like my background is in 3D effects and in my favorite thing to do was modeling 3D environments, which are essentially game levels, right? Yeah. And so photoreal game levels, like rendered and realized three-dimensionally, it's a very interesting art form to me. So what seems to be the thing that is incredible, if you were to grab some, you know, some alien that wasn't from our planet and show them entertainment in the 21st century, if you were to show them a three-dimensionally realized, you know, level where players from anywhere on the globe can log in and face off against one another, that is an infinitely more interesting archetype than a self-contained linear, where it doesn't even matter if it's open story or linear, but as an experience where these other consciousnesses are not involved, this is more interesting.
Yeah.
So I'm just automatically more interested. And I think if you're looking for the narrative experience, you're probably better off in film.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's kind of a weird, I haven't totally figured that out, but I know that I'm not really interested in that. Yeah. I just more want to blow stuff up and shoot people.
Like, if given the opportunity, would you like to be involved in like making a narrative driven like FPS game, for example?
No.
Okay.
No, but I would be insanely interested in, I mean, my skill set is basically designed for making an FPS, right? Yeah. I love weapons design. I love design. I love sound design. I love shit exploding.
Yeah.
Like I'm the dude, right? So like blow shit up. Like, but the narrative part of it is the part that just, I don't get. Like, you know, I could just go straight into multiplayer.
Yeah. Well, I think it's hard with a video game because obviously you need to interact. Like the story that you want to tell is not necessarily the story that I want to play out.
No, that's the thing. I mean, it's all about the best way to do it if it's not in the multiplayer environment is like it needs to be a completely open environment, you know, that has exponentially more work put into it with exponentially more avenues you can go down and outcomes and just basically make it like real life.
Yeah.
It's why I love GTA 5 so much.
Exactly.
Is because of that, you know.
It's the perfect example.
It's insane how much respect I have for like how that was made and realized.
Yeah.
Why do you think we're yet to get a great movie out of a video game adaptation?
Why do you think we don't?
Yeah, that hasn't happened yet.
I don't really know why. It doesn't make sense to me. Peter Jackson and I used to talk about that a little bit when I was going to do Halo, where we didn't really have an answer. And, you know, you can make a good film about anything. You just need a good story around it. Yeah. So it doesn't really make complete sense. I mean, I my experience on Halo and, you know, I was involved with Halo. I mean, let me summarize it. There's, I think, sometimes an unwillingness to deviate slightly from the sacred source material in a way that you have to do if you're moving into a different medium.
Yeah.
That was what I found to be the biggest roadblock. And that may be happening across the other films and the other IPs that, you know, that I don't know about that haven't yielded great movies.
Yeah, yeah.
But I suspect it would be in that territory.
Because, yeah. You know, there are so many like amazing kind of worlds that, you know, as a gamer myself,
no, totally.
I'd love to explore further. Like Metal Gear Solid is a brilliant example.
Yeah.
Why there hasn't been a film of that.
Yeah.
Considering it's so cinematic in the first place.
I think a lot of it really is maybe political. I mean, I don't know, but it's like, you know, you have this situation like Metal Gear Solid is a good example where, what's his name? Hideo
Kojima. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, I don't know. I'm just speculating, but you have like these almost like rock stars in video games that make shit like that. Right. Yeah. And that translation, when the director starts getting involved, it's like, you're now playing with their baby.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And but also this medium doesn't translate to this one.
Yeah.
And I think that crossover and the politics that happen there can create for not great films.
Yeah.
But I totally agree with you. I mean, I see stuff in film, I mean, in games every day where I'm like, you know, that's just amazing. Like,
yeah.
That concept is incredible right there.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, Kojima he's very open about his influences within film and just general pop culture. But I think I agree, like, he is that game. So I think if there ever was going to be a film, he'd probably want to direct it.
Yeah. It's almost like you just want to get the best script written.
Yeah.
And let him run with it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's probably the best way to do it.
Yeah.
Do you think a Halo movie will ever happen?
It may. I mean, I'm so done with it and so detached from it that I have no idea.
Yeah.
I literally have no idea. I mean, from experience multiple times now connected to that, I can tell you that it's like politics every time has just... That's a perfect example, though. When you talk about a world, it's really interesting. The character of Master Chief is still one of my favorite characters.
Yeah.
Like this guy that is fighting for something that has essentially... bastardized him and removed him from the things that he's fighting for other people to experience, that freedom and that, you know, what makes humans human has basically been kind of removed from him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just, I mean, when you play it, you're not thinking about that. You're like, oh, he's a cool soldier.
Yeah.
And he's running around blowing people up. But if you actually get into the character, it's unbelievably interesting. So I don't know what's going to happen with it. I mean, I would love to be an audience member and watch a really well-realized Halo film because it is like ripe with insanely good concepts and material. And like the mythology is huge, you know, like all of the different planets and the species. And whoever does it can call me up though. Like I've got like reams of stuff that I can, they don't need to use it, but I can just throw some ideas out there if they want.
Well, I think like Bungie as a developer are very good at creating the backstory to all the kind of games in the world. Have you played Destiny much at all?
I actually haven't played Destiny, but I went down to Bungie and saw them during the development of Destiny.
Right.
And I always just love that company's cool. Like I just kind of walked, got toured around and stuff, and you know, it felt like at the time like it was something that was really interesting.
It feels like they're creating more than just the game that's going to live on the shelves for a year or whatever it might be.
My favorite game company is Valve.
Really?
Mm.
So did you enjoy the sort of, because it's interesting you said the multiplayer part of Half-Life 2, which I don't think I've heard anybody say in terms of their favorite game. It's the single player.
Half-Life and Half-Life 2 are probably, again, this is so subjective, but in my personal opinion, it's probably the most kind of interesting... you know, first person narrative journey.
Yeah.
But I also played it at a different time in my life. Like
of course,
where so I don't really know how that, if playing it fresh now, like how that would affect me.
Yeah.
But yeah, back in the day, I mean, it had a massive effect on me.
Yeah.
One of my friends in the company that we used to work at wrote like this like impassioned like essay to Valve about like how much it affected him basically.
Right.
And but yeah, I was obsessive with it. Like and then it did turn into the multiplayer thing.
Yeah.
I was directing commercials and I was like part owner of a visual effects company, and like all the animators in the company, I literally would get on like the PA system and I'd be like, stop working on the commercial. I'm starting a server. And then I actually had like one or two guys were like, dude, we gotta and I'm like, I'm the director and we're playing a game now for 2 hours. And so that's probably why, like I said, I can beat anyone in London. It's probably the amount of hours that
you've clocked.
Yeah, just using that, like, you know, the bolt, the iron
Yeah.
Rebar.
It's an amazing goal. Amazing game. But and it, not a week goes by where we don't get asked when Half-Life 3 is coming out.
Yeah.
Like, I have no idea.
Yeah.
Ask Valve.
Ask Gabe.
Yeah, exactly.
You sound like the best boss ever.
Yeah. No, that was, I was like, man, I couldn't get enough of that. Just assassinating dudes when they're like a pixel and the rebar is just, you know, just right in the head.
If you'd made your Halo movie, would we have not got District 9?
No, we totally wouldn't have gotten District 9. I mean, the best thing that ever happened to my career was not directing Halo. You know, and that's, I'm not saying like District 9 was that great. I'm just saying what happened, if you look at it from my perspective, is I got into a place where I was allowed to develop my own ideas. Yeah. And that's a rare thing for filmmakers to be able to do a lot of the time, especially in this genre. And it was because of Peter Jackson and Fran Walsh. Like, the film collapsed, and within 24 hours, they were like, what do you want to do next? Like, we'll help you do whatever you want to do next, which is insane, because normally you'd be packing your bags and be out of New Zealand, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's... So for me, it was like this really amazing... It was like super terrible when it happened. I mean, I think we had like 40... Some could even be 70 people that were like on payroll on Halo.
Wow.
And it was like, yeah, it was like a last minute thing. I mean, we all knew it was like dodgy, but we were still forging ahead. And then it was just like one morning, entire project's dead.
And you were able to take some of what you'd done though, where you and transfer it over to District 9?
No. You never want to do that. I mean, it doesn't, the equation doesn't work that way. Like, it's not like hours in mean it's going to make District 9 better. It's like, it's the thought processes that went into creating this stuff are based on this universe and this world. It doesn't translate.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. But there are like just, I mean, reams of stuff, you know, millions of dollars of pre-production.
Crazy.
That's crazy.
The question we got the most, which I'm sure you've heard before, but I will call people out on it a little bit. Sean One Neo says, any sequels planned for any of your movies? Super Smellis says, will there be a sequel to District 9? And Year of the Rat says, really looking forward to Chappie, but are we going to see Vickers again?
Yeah, so very, very District 9 centric.
Yes.
Yeah.
I talk to Peter Jackson sometimes about District 10, actually. And it's like what I was saying earlier about this weird 3-year process per film of just how long it takes, and it sort of takes you out of the game, and you know, you've got to decide what you want to make. But this is my answer. Like, I would love, I have an idea for District 10, which is really cool. The problem is I feel like Chappie is the end of three films that have a similar stylistic approach to them. Chappie is the odd one out in that it has no socio-political underpinnings. It doesn't have my experience as a kid in South Africa incorporated into it. And Elysium, although it doesn't have my experiences as a kid in South Africa, it has the same notion of oppressor, you know, in the elites and like the large population base beneath it. And Chappie doesn't, but they are still part of like a trilogy. So so moving forward, it's like I would love to realize this idea of District 10. I have every intention to do it. I just need to find the right time to do it, to not go back to Johannesburg and shoot something similar yet. That's basically my answer.
Was that something, that idea for District 10, was that something that was all part of District 9 that you had in your mind when you were putting that? So, because it kind of almost ends on a bit of a cliffhanger and we don't know where it's going. At the time, did you not know where that was headed?
No. Wow. No, I had no idea. I had no idea to the point that I didn't. I remember walking into Peter Jackson's office, which was down the road, down the hall from the editing room I was in, when we had finally, like, the edit was locked and like the movie was basically done. And I walked into his office and I was like, you know that the ending of the film is like for a sequel. And he may have known that all along, but like I didn't, right? So he was like, yeah, it is sort of, isn't it? And then the film came out and I left New Zealand. But no, there was zero premeditated. I was not hinting at anything and nothing was thought of.
That blows my mind, because I've had quite a few arguments with people about where we think the alien's coming from there and what his intentions are and where that's going to go. And that's interesting. I was so sure I was right.
Yeah.
And yet I guess it was, there wasn't a right answer because
It was a completely self-contained story about the Nazi becoming, you know, the Holocaust victim, basically. Mm. It was the oppressor becoming the oppressed. And when it's based on a character like that, it ends with that character. The inadvertent world creation that came with it, which to me is like my perfect kind of thing that I love, like having a bunch of weird alien weapons in the back of a shack somewhere that you can discover. That's like ripe for, you know, just creative insanity. So it took a few years to kind of process like what that could be. And I think the story that I have now is like, it's what I would want to see as a fan of the first film, I think. I know I would want to see it. I assume other people would.
I want to see it.
Yeah, it's good, man.
Okay, let's. Sorry, go
on. I was just going to ask, what is it about like Charlton Copley that you love working with?
I think it's a bunch of things. I mean, you know, the main thing really is just how talented he is.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really ultimately what it is. Like, I'm really good friends with him, but my whole, like, my knowing him as friends in South Africa, all of my memories of him are just him always in character. He's right. Like, you know, like the loudest friend that you have that's just like constantly like one character or another. He's a lot like that. Right. So he never thought he was an actor and he never ever spoke to me about acting. We both spoke about wanting to be directors. And when I was preparing for District 9, I went back to South Africa and shot like a test. It was mostly to show Peter what I thought the tone of the movie would be.
Yeah.
Handheld documentary footage about aliens. And I knew that for the test, he could pull off playing this Afrikaans bureaucrat to show Peter what the vibe would be. And then we go and find a proper actor.
Yeah.
And while I was shooting it, I was like, this guy is so good. It's ridiculous. And then I showed Pete and he was like, you got to cast him, man.
Yeah.
And I didn't think that was going to be like viable that he would say that. But he was like, no, you should use him. And so I was like, okay, that is awesome. Yeah. I didn't expect that to be a reality. And so that kind of led to me actually really thinking about Charles as a performer and just how much depth he actually has.
Yeah.
And so I think Hollywood hasn't exploited that in him as much as I know there is to be exploited.
Sure.
And that's what led to Chappie, you know. I mean, Chappie, if you read Chappie and you think of the movie and you go to an actor to try to play Chappie, if you actually just think about it, it's extremely weird.
Yeah.
Like what that character is. I mean, the discussions you would get into with like traditional actors about playing that character would be like, you know, your brain would explode.
Yeah.
It's an 8-year-old.
Yeah.
But he has an IQ of 800.
Yeah.
And they're like, no.
Right.
But I knew that he would just cane it. And he is probably my favorite part of the film. Chappie is probably my favorite part of the film. The realization of an emotional robot.
Yeah. Do you think that you'll always cast him in your films? Is it
no,
now?
There's no reason or necessity for it to always be him. So I don't live by any rule like that. But I am appreciative of how much better he makes the films because of how talented he is. And then just being friends with him, it's like we always just end up goofing around, like, you know.
Gotcha.
At the back of me, you know, hating the shooting process so much.
Right.
It's good to have a mate there.
Yeah, exactly.
Someone who's got your back.
And it wouldn't be that awkward the day when you go, actually, you're not on this film.
Not this one. Yeah.
Man Out of Time wants to know, what is it about the sci-fi genre that keeps pulling you back in? And I'd like to kind of add to that. You've talked about these three films being kind of aesthetically or thematically similar in some way, shape, or form. Will the next film be totally out of that genre? Will it be something totally different? Oh, you're doing Alien, of course.
Yeah.
But then after that, like, will you move away from sci-fi?
Well, the thing is, again, going back to the fact that I'm not actually sure that I'm a director, meaning, like, I don't have some, like, weird checklist in the back of my house where I'm, like, leading up eventually to, like, the Oscar film, you know, with some, like, riveting performance. I'm not interested in that. So I have no qualms about being like, I just do sci-fi or I just do whatever. Like, absolutely no problem with that because I'm like an artist that just does what they like doing. But what I will say is this. I need there to be in the film something otherworldly. Otherwise, I'm not interested. So for whatever weird reason, it's been science fiction. Like the stories, the themes that I've wanted to touch on have just needed sci-fi. But it doesn't need to be science fiction. It can be fantasy. It can be horror. It can be, as long as I am allowed to twist reality, I'm in. If it's the only thing I could imagine doing in mundane day-to-day life is a war film. I love war movies. That I would do. But other than that, no. So it's not science fiction. It's just something fantastical.
It's a little bit different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I'm game.
Here's a question from Daylight Fire. They simply wrote Alien or Aliens, or is that the impossible?
You know that it was Aliens. Aliens was my favorite film. It's not even a choice between the two. Aliens was my favorite film ever made. But I just saw Alien which was a close second. I just saw Alien in a theatrical projection in Vancouver, which I've never seen before. It's only ever been on, you know, I was born the year it came out in theaters.
Right.
And seeing it in a theater, it may have jumped ahead because it's just that good. But yeah, it's a really tough one.
Alex, Alien or Aliens?
Similar. It was always Aliens for me, but then I rewatched Alien only about 3 months ago. And there is something very special about that film that I probably didn't appreciate when I was younger because it was all Colonial Marines. True. So.
What about you?
Alien.
Alien.
Always has been. I think it's a perfect film.
Yeah.
I love Aliens, but there's the odd scene, there's the odd moment, and there's bits that I think go on too long. Whereas Alien, I just think it's such a perfect, self-contained, brilliant horror film. And it's such an inspired idea, you know?
Yeah. I agree.
I want to see a good third Alien movie. That's what I want to see.
Yeah. Whereabouts does your movie fit within that? Do you go the horror route that Alien has or the action movie that is Aliens?
Can't get into it. I don't want to give away too much.
Matabasta, whatever that is, says you are great at making the worlds in your films feel real. What would you say is your main skill that helps you to do this? So, yeah, the world building is pretty impressive in all three films. So where does that come from?
I think it comes from a number of places, but I mean, like, I suppose there's two ways to kind of sum that up. Like, if people like what they're seeing, there's the fantastical, weird elements that make it not every day. But then there's also the thing that I find particularly appealing myself, which is to take the weird elements and paint them with like a brush of reality. So the weird shit actually feels kind of normal. That's easier to answer than the first part. I don't know if that makes sense or not.
But
so the second part, I use economics to determine the reality of things often. Often it's like when you talk about film design, designers just go crazy and they just come up with a bunch of cool stuff. And visually it looks cool. But there's no real questions asked about like how do you get there? And it's really interesting if you go through any aspect of your life or even when you look at history – you know, at the sort of the advent of currency, it really is money that determines how things look. It's kind of incredible. What's the purpose? This is the purpose. Okay, how do we achieve that purpose at the lowest dollar figure?
Yeah.
You know, and so I often use that as a way to like know that I'm designing something. This is in the case of going for reality. This is not in the case of like doing something like Lord of the Rings or, you know, something that's just like fantastical and amazing. I'll approach it from like an economic standpoint and just try to make it feel real, knowing that the actual thing is ridiculous. It's a weird concept.
Mm.
You know, it's weird.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, we're getting near to the end of our time. So let's bring it back to Chappie before we come to a close. You mentioned about the couple of musicians that you have in your film.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about and what did they bring to the project? Because they're quite out there.
Yeah, well, what happened there was in about 2010, I became aware of Dion Fuert and, you know, their music. And I think that they're more than musicians just because of they're like artists that are like this all-encompassing thing. And I kept thinking I really want to put them in a film just because they're so unique. And then I had this idea for Chappie out of nowhere, which was them. It was them raising this robot from scratch. And I knew that even though they weren't classically trained as actors, I knew that they create this like intrigue in people, you know, love them or hate them. They kind of like, they're like mystifying and they sort of like draw you in because you're like, what the hell am I watching here? And I knew that they would create that feeling for audiences where you kind of are sort of, there's a magnetic thing about them that you feel like you must watch. So that's how I found them. And then I wanted them to be themselves a few years after their music career had tanked, which they were game for. So that's why they have like all this like leftover merchandise and stuff in their den. That's why they're always wearing themselves in their t-shirts.
Right.
And then I had an idea for the score that I wanted to do that didn't exactly work out. And I was sort of messing with it. And then Hans Zimmer has been my favorite, you know, composer since I was like 15, pretty much. And so I went to him and I was like, can you do a score? Because the movie is about artificial intelligence and it's like robotics and it's like very digital. Can we not orchestrate anything? So it's an entirely digitally created score. And can we also put like some kind of Vangelis, like Blade Runner synth in there, like actual synth, not synthesizer, but actual like valve synth. Yeah. And he was like, well, funny you should say that, because he just like bought up all of Roland's like 70s synthesizers and has them in a warehouse in LA. And I was like, wow, awesome. And so what he came up with is one of my favorite parts of the film, which is like how the score sounds. It sounds amazing, you know.
It's a really unusual
score.
Yeah,
and it's unusual. So so that's the music in the film.
Cool. And you've not done a sequel to one of your films in the past, but are there more stories in this universe that you could potentially tell if this is a success and you feel like going back to this world?
There are. I mean, you know, the thing that there's like there's something very creative I find about sequels. Like, it happened to me with the District 9 sequel when I started thinking about it. And then it's happened to me with Chappie as well, where it's very difficult to sit down with a blank piece of paper and just invent a bunch of shit. And there's something really creative about like de-burdening yourself from needing to do that. And having these pre-existing characters and kind of knowing their characters and where they can go, that is actually very creative. So the answer to Chappie is yes, there are other, Chappie actually, unlike District 9, in treatment form was actually written as a trilogy. So I actually know where the other two films go if it ever turns out.
Yeah. Can you tell us that right now?
Negative.
Great. Well, that's been really interesting, Neil. Thanks for giving us your time and talking so candidly about everything. That's it for this week. But yeah. I should tell everyone that Chappie is out today when this podcast drops, which is March the 6th. So all go and see it. And as ever, thank you for listening and watching.
Thank you.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.